From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. A live concert on this edition of Fresh Air, featuring Barbara Kay and Pat McDonald, better known as Timbuk3. They had a hit with their song, The Future's So Bright, I Gotta Wear Shades. Now they're back with a new album called Eden Alley. Also, we examine the trade-offs between domestic security and personal growth with novelist Hilma Wolitzer. Her new novel is about a middle-aged couple trying to save their marriage on the eve of their silver anniversary. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the Dominoes, the 50s R&B group that launched the careers of Jackie Wilson and Clyde McFadder. And book critic John Leonard reviews A Far Cry from Kensington by Muriel Spark, who also wrote The Prime of Miss Jean Brody. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. With me on Fresh Air for a live concert are Barbara Kay and Pat McDonald, the husband and wife team duo that make up the band Timbuk3. They had a hit with their song The Future's So Bright, I Gotta Wear Shades, one of the tracks on their first album. Their new album, Eden Alley, is on IRS Records. Rock critic Ed Ward wrote, "It's obvious from listening to this record that Timbuk3 is in it for the long haul, that the idea is not to top the last hit with something that sounds a lot like it, but to just keep on writing and playing and singing good songs. Most of the songs are written by Pat. Barbara also does some of the writing. Now, it's going to sound as if there's a lot more than two performers playing. That's because Timbuk3 travels with a cassette tape of their rhythm tracks so that they can keep the band streamlined and low-tech without sacrificing the sound that they want. But the guitars, the harmonica, the vocals, that's all live. I want to welcome you both to Fresh Air. Would one of you introduce the first song you're going to do for us?
Yeah, here's one called Reverend Jack and His Roman Cadillac Church. Okay, here we go.
Roman Cadillac Church. You know you watching the road, son, when you ride in his automobile. We're all backseat drivers, and there's nobody at the wheel.
That really sounds terrific. And performing, whoops, you can tell by the feedback that we are live. Performing for us is Timbuk3, and that's Pat McDonald and Barbara Kay. And, you know, before we talk about how you met and started playing together and the kinds of songs that you write, I just want to talk a little bit about the kind of setup that you have, because our listeners can't see it or anything, but next to you, Pat, is a boom box and a big mixing, well, patch board. And I like this idea that you've been working on for several years of having your rhythm track on tape and playing that in a boombox. How did you first start doing that?
Well, we started in Madison, Wisconsin, which is where we lived for many years. And we had a band that broke up, and we decided to try to make as much music as we could with just the two of us, have it portable so we could travel around and play anywhere. So we had the idea of putting bass, guitar, and drums through a drum machine onto cassettes and putting them on our boombox, and that way we could play on the street or we could play in clubs or in anywhere we wanted to play, travel around and find a place to live, or we could continue to make a living playing music.
Well, playing here is a good example of how well that can work, because if all of his instruments were here, they wouldn't fit acoustically in the room. So I can
right,
see how that would work.
Right now we have our crew is setting up us to play at a gig at the club tonight, and so we have another set of equipment that's a little less portable than this setup that we use in clubs too. So this is kind of like our, this is for the back of the bus, sort of.
It started as a financial thing in part, right, so that you could, you know, be portable and travel and not have a big band on salary. But if you could afford it, would you still use, or because you probably could afford now to have more band members? Has it become an aesthetic as much as a financial thing?
It's not so much of an economic necessity as maybe, you know, the initial inspiration behind it, although that wasn't totally it either. We felt real confident with each other, and we had a lot of faith and trust in each other too to play our music. And now we just have a lot of fun. That's basically why we keep doing it like we do. It's a creative challenge to come up with all the parts yourselves. We record, when we make our albums, we play all the instruments. And so this way we just recreate what we do in the studio live on stage.
Barbara, you're holding a violin now.
Right.
Can you do another song for us? One, I guess, in which the violin will figure.
Sure.
Yeah, I need phones back to where they were. Thank you.
This one is called Too Much Sex and Not Enough Affection.
Scene of the crime, body in the bed. One victim died, one victim fled. A slave to desire, rejection. Too much sex and not enough affection. Read it in the paper or watch it on TV. Cry for a stranger and turn your back on me. Try another line and still no connection. Too much sex and not enough affection. Go, but it ain't no way to live. That's one way to go, but
body in the bed. One victim died, one victim fled. He never got caught, but he lost his re-election. Too much sex, not enough affection. That's one way to go, there ain't no way to live. That's one way to go, there ain't no way to live. It's too much to take, not enough to give. Too much.
And that's Too Much Sex, Not Enough Affection, which is also on your new album, Eden Alley. My guests are Timbuk3. They're performing live for us. And, you know, your voices are such a perfect fit together. It sounds to me, the harmonies. And I wonder how you started singing together, and when you started singing together, if you automatically hit on that right harmonic balance between you.
Actually, we've gone through a lot of different phases with it. Because there, I turned that microphone off.
I should explain.
When we started out,
it's the boombox and the microphones and headphones. Yeah. It's pretty tricky in here.
We're talking through one mic and singing through another.
Yeah.
And we worked on it a lot because at first we just sang together for the fun of it, and then a lot of times I sing harmony and Barbara would sing the melody, and lately Barbara's gotten more into doing both. Things, because I used to kind of come up with harmony parts and teach them to her, and now she comes up with her own parts, you know, and it's been like that for the last few years.
Now, you were both playing separately before you met, right? You were both performing separately?
Well, both of us have been playing guitar since, you know, we were kids,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't start playing professionally until I was, you know, maybe 8 or 9 years ago. But when I met Pat, it was about 10 and a half years, so I heard him in concert, and then I was inspired to practice more and get my act together. And then we were both playing solo in the clubs around Wisconsin, small bars, and then we each had a band for a while, and then I quit my band and joined his.
Barbara, did you play guitar before?
Before I met
Pat? Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. I've been playing guitar since I was about 10 years old.
Did you have any flack from teachers or anything learning electric guitar when you were young?
No, I played acoustic guitar until I was about 20 years old, and then I started playing electric guitar.
You know, something I have to ask you both, you had that hit a couple of years ago, The Future's So Bright I Gotta Wear Shades. Did your lives really change a lot after that? I think once you have a hit, the pressure's on, first of all, to have another one.
I think people have more expectations once something has been established. You know, it was kind of a surprise, and it was often misunderstood, the intent and the nature and the irony in the song.
Pat, you wrote the song. You want to explain how it was intended and how it was misunderstood?
Well, it seemed pretty clear to me. You know, it's just there's a lot of songs that are more satirical. You know, a lot of, you know, double meanings and things, and people are pretty smart generally. They can figure out these things, and you know, I try to put little pointers in the song to mm-hmm. say, hey, I'm only kidding, you know, or whatever. It's a little bit, but you hear something on the radio and you hear it right next to a Pepsi commercial, and of course anything you hear on the radio, on certain types of radio stations, of course, you know, you're gonna expect something pretty shallow, you know, or you know, you might think, okay, what's this advertising? You know, what's this song an ad for? And I think therefore you tend to hear the, you know, the most surface interpretation of the song initially until you hear it a few times, and then, you know, then hopefully the thing kind of opens up.
Do you feel that you've been able or that you've wanted to make any changes based on the success of that song, financial or otherwise?
How do you mean?
Well, with I don't know, with the money that you get from a hit song, you can you can do things that you dreamed
well, see,
of before. But could
we put it all
realize.
Back into our music? Mm-hmm. We just we buy some of the equipment we need, so that we can have consistent sound.
Yeah. And we also work with a lot more people now, so we have a more professional show instead of me and Pat showing up. You know, a couple hours before we play and setting everything up, we have people who help us on the road now.
Well, I'd love to hear some more of your music, but first we have to take a short break, and then we'll be back with Tim Buck III, Barbara Kay, and Pat McDonald, and they'll perform some more songs for us. They also have a new album out, by the way, called Eden Alley. It's on IRS Records. Are you touring nationally now also?
Right, yes, we are.
So maybe they'll be touring through your city as well. We'll be back in just a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Barbara Kay and Pat McDonald, my guests, the members of Tim Buck III. And can I ask you to play another song?
Yes.
Which one do you want to do?
You know what I have to do real quickly here? I have to tune my guitar.
Okay. Well, you
guys can talk about the song a little bit while I tune my guitar.
You're going to do Little People?
Oh, yeah. Do you want to play that one, Pat?
Sure.
Little People Make Big Mistakes is the name of the song.
And I should mention that this is going to be one without the boombox, so everything you're hearing performed on this particular song is happening live. Performed in the studio. Pat, this is a song that you wrote?
Yes.
Right.
I can't hear this guitar.
Okay, we need more on the headphones?
Yeah.
Okay.
Check, one, two. I'm sorry, we lost the guitar.
We lost the guitar. Do we know what to do about that? We got it again. Okay.
One, two, three.
Sometimes little people make big mistakes. Sometimes mountains crumble. Sometimes a heart breaks. We seek love endlessly. We trust our eyes to see. But sometimes little people make big mistakes. I never meant to hurt you, but what can I say? Just happened that way.
Good song and really well performed. Thank you both. Pat, when you're writing, did you want something with the...
We're done with the song.
Okay. When you're writing a song, does it tend to spring whole, the melody, or do you actually sit and work on it as it happens?
Well, a lot of times the guitar parts come first, but sometimes when I don't have a guitar, a lot of times I work on the words and melody at the same time, and I'll just be singing the words and the melody, and the words and the melody will come at the same time. When I've got a guitar, a lot of times the guitar part will come first, or maybe the drum machine part, and then I'll just kind of hum along with the guitar thing, and a lot of times when it works like that, the melody will come first and then the words will come later. But if I don't have a guitar, it seems usually the words and the melody come more like you're just sitting there singing to yourself, making up this little words and melody thing, which becomes a song.
Are there subjects you know you want to write a song about?
Yeah, a lot of times the ones I want to write a song about are the ones I don't usually end up able to write a song about. It's a lot of times the songs that just kind of jump out at you, things that you don't really expect to be writing about. A phrase will just somehow pass through your mind, and it just seems to have some kind of pull to it, and you follow that phrase, and it just takes you on this weird route, and it sometimes I don't have much control over what I might write about. Some things that are real important to me are really hard to write about, and then, you know, other times it may be years before a song comes of something that I've thought about, you know.
You both strike me as people who want to keep control over the music that you're doing and not hand it over to a record company or to a promoter or anything like that. Are there things you feel you have to be wary of in the rock world that you want to stay clear of while negotiating your own direction?
Well, you just, when you have a hit song, or you have any kind of interest from the public or whatever, there's a lot of people who stand to profit from that, and they'll try to nudge you in a direction that might get you more attention more quickly, you know. And
it's
something
or another.
Yeah, and so it's, you have to know what's right for yourself and what you feel comfortable with, what suits your personality, and not, you know, it can be real difficult to be always sort of at odds with really well-meaning people, you know, but you just really have to learn how to say, oh, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that, that's silly, and, you know, that type of thing, and you know, it can be really small things. You know, it can be, you know, where you get a photo taken, or you know what I mean. It's like you don't want to appear to be publicity mongers, which we're not. And although there's a big publicity machine that you can get connected to, and
no, am I right in saying that you're going to open for a Bob Dylan tour?
We're going to be opening about 6 shows for him in the end of August and early September up in Canada in the northeast.
Can you tell me briefly how you feel about opening for him? If you see that as a good opportunity, or?
Well, I don't know if how I'm going to feel walking out on the stage with this harmonica rack around.
Yeah,
my mouth,
so. Right.
That's about the only thing that, so about the only reservation I have.
Well, you think he's going to say something?
Not him, no. It's my own thing. It's totally.
Is he the one who inspired you to play harmonica?
I started playing harmonica on a rack like this years and years ago, and I'm sure it was, of course, inspired by him originally, and then you know, other people have done it, but of course he's the one who's the most famous for it. Neil Young plays on a rack too, and John Hammond Jr. and you know, a lot of people who are good, you know, but it's just a way to get the job done. You play guitar and harmonica at the same time. It's the way you can do it. And although it's funny though, it's a very Dylan-esque image. So
let's see if I could give you another chance to play guitar and harmonica together at the same time. Maybe you could play one more song for us.
Sure.
Would you like to sample the dog? We could do that.
Or are they going to do Love Times
Three?
Yeah.
Okay, is that the one we're going to fade out on?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Okay, and this is Timbuk3, and they do have a new album as well called Eden Alley. And what's happening here is that they have a boom box in which they have their rhythm track recorded, so they're just queuing that up right now. The guitars are live, the harmonica is live, the voices are live. Indeed, the concert is live, but we got the rhythm track on tape, and as soon as that's set, we're ready to go. Concert. I want to thank you both so much for performing for us. And performing live for us has been Timbuk3. That's Barbara Kay and Pat McDonald. And they have a new album if you'd like to hear them on record as well. It's called Eden Alley. It's on the IRS record label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And tomorrow, join us for a conversation with record producer Huey Moe. So I hope you can be with us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Hilma Wolitzer was a suburban homemaker for many years before she tried to write. Now she's a successful novelist. Her new novel, Silver, is about a middle-aged couple caught between domestic complacency and individual self-fulfillment. Coming up, Hilma Wolitzer discusses the conflicts in her characters' lives and in her own. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the 50s group The Dominoes. Ed says the group's leader may have been tough to work for, but he sure knew a good singer when he heard one. Among his finds, Jackie Wilson and Clyde McFadder. And book critic John Leonard reviews A Far Cry from Kensington, the latest novel by Muriel Spark. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Michael Dukakis has named Texas Senator Lloyd Benson as running mate on the 1988 Democratic presidential ticket. Dukakis made the announcement today in Boston. More from NPR's Linda Wertheimer.
Lloyd Benson was elected to the Senate in 1970, defeating the Republican congressman from Houston, George Bush. But Benson brings more to the Democratic ticket than that experience. Known to the business community across the country as chairman of the tax-writing Senate Finance Committee, Benson moves the ticket a bit to the right and holds out the possibility that the Democrats could carry Texas. Traditionally, when Democrats carry Texas, they win. Benson applauded Dukakis' decision to reach out from Massachusetts in the Northeast to Texas in the Southwest.
Choose a representative from that part of the country. Wants that kind of input, an inclusive campaign that reaches out across America. That's what Michael Dukakis has done, and it's going to be a winner.
Texas Senator Lloyd Benson speaking today at Faneuil Hall in Boston. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
Democratic runner-up Jesse Jackson said today he is too controlled and mature to be angry at being passed over for the Democratic vice presidential nomination. Jackson called the selection of Benson a strategic move and pledged his support for the ticket to be chosen by the party convention next week. He said he first learned of the decision from reporters who met him this morning at the airport in Washington. He said Dukakis later phoned him, but they did not have a lengthy discussion. Former Pennsylvania Governor Richard Thornburgh was nominated today by President Reagan to replace Edwin Meese as Attorney General. The president called on the Senate to quickly ratify the man he called the ideal choice for the job. Details from NPR's Brian Naylor.
Appearing in the White House briefing room alongside his nominee, President Reagan had high praise for the former two-term governor and U.S. attorney.
Dick Thornburgh was a prosecutor's prosecutor for 6 years. As a United States attorney for Western Pennsylvania. A tough-minded crime buster, winning an unprecedented number of convictions for corruption and against members of organized crime.
The president brushed aside all questions in his appearance before reporters this morning. Thornburgh said his nomination was a great honor and privilege, and that his major challenge as attorney general will be to provide leadership at the Justice Department. Thornburgh said it was premature to answer whether he'll be asked to stay on should Vice President Bush be elected president in November. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
By a vote of 84 to 11, the Senate today approved a bill elevating the Veterans Administration to a cabinet-level department. The House approved its own version last year. Differences will now be worked out in conference committee. Today, South Africa's justice minister indefinitely suspended the execution of the Sharpeville Six. The five black men and one woman were sentenced to death for their part in the mob killing of a black township official. The case caused great controversy in South Africa and abroad because the six were not found directly guilty of causing the man's death. Instead, they were convicted of having common purpose with his killers. Lawyers for the six say they will now exhaust every legal appeal for their clients. Authorities in Athens today released photographs of three suspects in yesterday's gun and grenade attack on board a Greek cruise ship. 11 people died, nearly 80 were wounded. Officials say the terrorist assault could be linked to this week's trial in Athens of a Palestinian wanted by the United States in the 1982 bombing of a Pan Am jetliner over Hawaii. Authorities believe the gunman may have been trying to hijack the cruise ship to force the release of the Palestinian. Stock prices closed sharply lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 18 points to close at 2092.46. Declines led advances 3-1 on volume of 163 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Singers Clyde McFadder and Jackie Wilson were big names in rock and roll in the 50s and 60s. McFadder sang with the Drifters and later as a solo performer. Wilson was one of the pioneers of soul music. Both McFadder and Wilson started their careers with Billy Ward and the Dominoes. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, no relation to Billy, has a profile of the group.
If you don't like chicken, leave that hen alone.
There are some groups that just seem to give birth to stars one after another. In jazz, there's Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers, and in gospel, the Caravans for women singers and the Soul Stirrers for men. In the mid-50s, rhythm and blues had Billy Ward and the Dominoes for a training academy. Billy Ward was a most unlikely candidate for rock and roll stardom. He was born into a middle-class black family in Los Angeles and was a musical child prodigy who won a national award for a piano composition at the age of 14. The world of classical music was pretty much closed to blacks in the 30s, though, so Ward joined the army and became a boxer. After his discharge, he edited a sports magazine in New York City, but his heart was still in music. He took a studio near Carnegie Hall and began giving voice lessons. One day, he realized he had enough talented students to form a first-rate vocal group, so he did. He called them the Dominoes, and they did unspectacularly until the day in 1950 when a 17-year-old kid named Clyde McFatter joined, and the rest, as they say, is history. Scouted by King Records, the group hit the Rhythm and Blues Top 10 the first time out with Do Something For Me.
No greater need, and it is true, than the need I have for you. So baby, can't you see, you must do something for me.
Something for me.
And with their third record, they hit the top with the best-selling single of 1951, one of those risque records the newly emerging rock and rollers loved so well, the classic 60 Minute Man. Consistent with Ward's policy of showing off everybody's vocal skills, that featured a lead vocal by bass singer Bill Brown. Still, they knew that Clyde McFatter was their most impressive lead singer, and in 1953 they pushed him out front again and pushed themselves to the top with Have Mercy, Baby. McFatter's voice floats effortlessly over the top, while the other guys just fill in the gaps. By the way, Ward didn't sing at all on these records. He's the piano player. He was also a stern and fairly humorless man to work for, to hear people talk, and he had a strict set of rules his Dominoes had to follow or get fired. That actually worked in his favor, because one guy got fired and was replaced by young Jackie Wilson. Wilson and McFatter hit it off well, and they can both be heard on the last great hit by Billy Ward and the Dominoes, a record that's very hard to listen to, so hold on. Here's The Bells.
Brothers and sisters, we are gathered here.
Oh, 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 oh.
Therefore, black horses with eyes of flame red, their roses tied with ribbons all around my baby's head. The bells are ringing and they say I'll go and see. Well, I know why they're ringing. They're ringing out for me. Oh.
Ward's policy also worked against him. One of the group's biggest fans was Ahmet Erdogan, who owned Atlantic Records, a major rival of King. And one night he went to see the Dominoes at Birdland on 52nd Street in New York. Oddly enough, McFadder wasn't with them, so Erdogan, as calmly as he could, asked Ward where he was. "I fired him," Ward snarled, and Erdogan fairly flew to Harlem to sign one of the biggest stars Atlantic ever had. Ward also fired Jackie Wilson not long afterwards. The Dominoes played out their days as a sort of supper club group. "We aren't a rock and roll group anymore," Ward told the press in 1957 after turning down a club engagement in Hollywood, and he was right. It was probably a generational thing, but the young stars he launched made rock and roll history.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
Ashes to ashes, and dust to dust.
You're listening to Fresh Air. "Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket" was the title of the first short story published by Hilma Wolitzer. Wolitzer, at 35, was raising her two daughters and taking care of her suburban Long Island home when that story appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. She's written five novels since then, sticking with the themes of marriage and family life. Her new novel, Silver, is a sequel to her 1977 novel, In the Flesh. The main characters are Pauli Flax and her husband, Howard. The story opens on the eve of their silver anniversary as their life together is about to change.
"One night in August, understanding all at once why I'd been so sad, I decided to leave Howard. This was the real thing, not just the fireworks of battle or some transient post-battle blues. We hadn't even had a decent argument for months, and I wasn't giving Howard up the way he kept giving up cigarettes. I mean that I meant it. But do we ever know what we mean? Light years before, when I still believed we had made it for life like wolves, Howard left and went to live with another woman. After a while, he came back, and the children and I made room for him in the kitchen and the bedroom, ready to forgive, if not forget. I wish I could say that I had fallen in love this time, that I was rushing from the house with my skin on fire, and that Mr. Wonderful was going to roll me across the lawn and put out the flames. It wasn't like that, though. Howard and I were getting ready for bed, as we'd done for most of more than 24 years, moving through our old ballet of dropped shoes and emptied underwear. I realized that we didn't look frankly at one another's nakedness anymore. Waning interest made us glance away, and shyness of how we were changing. I guess Howard saw me the way I saw him, in hasty flashes of softened flesh before the lights went out."
Now, you wrote about these two characters in a 1977 novel called In the Flesh. Why did you bring them back for a new novel?
I didn't really bring them back. They just never left. They just kept living inside my head, and I always wondered what happened to them. And the way to find out was to write about them.
Now, shortly after the woman main character, Pauli, decides to leave her husband, he has a heart attack, and she
very inconvenient.
Yes. But she goes to see him in the hospital. And the next day she says, "Last night, I'd left the hospital with fear and with the weight of love and love's history." And I think in a way that's the real subject of your book, the weight of love and the weight of love's history.
I think it is, too. I think that when people are connected and share a history, they, even when they separate, they can't quite separate. There's always something going on between them. History becomes a palpable thing. And they were deeply in love, as they keep telling you. In alternating voices. They were very much in love.
In your new novel, the point of view alternates between the husband and the wife.
Yeah, that's new for me. That in the Flesh, in the original novel, it was all told through Pauli's point of view, and I finally decided that wasn't giving Howard his fair shake.
Yeah, now that really interests me, because I think that many women novelists really side with their woman protagonist and really see things from her point of view. especially in relationships.
And well, of course, but and I'm very sympathetic with Paulie. There's mm-hmm. there's no question about it. But I also see Howard as a real sympathetic whole person too. And I felt if he didn't tell his side of the story, then it wasn't fair. I think that in the end, my greatest sympathy is with her. She is the wronged party in this marriage, so to speak. But I like him too, and I grew to like him more as I began to let the story be told, and partly in his voice. I sort of understood his motives for what he did.
I guess that's a good exercise in trying to understand your character, to tell the story from their point of view.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun, too, to have your character not sound like a woman when it's meant to be a man. It was a big challenge.
Well, what did you have to do differently in terms of tone and...
Well, I always read my work aloud while I'm writing it, and if it begins to sound too much like me, I stop.
Now, you didn't start publishing until you were 35 years old. That was in 1965. Right. You published a short story?
My first short story in the old Saturday Evening Post, and I am really a late bloomer. And my first novel was published when I was 44.
And until then, you were a mother?
Say it, a housewife.
I hate that word. I really hate that word. And I hate homemaker also. There's something so...
Domestic. Even worse.
It reminds me of those junior high school classes in homemaking that the girls had to take.
And I failed at that anyway. when Ending first came out, when the first book was published, I got a great deal of press in the local papers on Long Island. And the headlines read things like, Housewife Turns Into Writer. And I had this vision of a woman going into a telephone booth, tearing off her apron, and coming out with a big W on her chest. And it wasn't like that. It was very gradual. First of all, I had no role model, and I didn't know any writers in those days, and I just started writing and was lucky enough to have things published. And it just kept going, and finally I found myself just so involved in it that I stopped making Jell-O.
Well, how did you start writing? What made you decide to pick up the pen?
I sat down one day and just wrote a short story, and I was really lucky. Through a series of coincidences, I was able to contact an agent, and the agent took me on, and she had faith in the story, and it was eventually sold, and I bought my first car with the sale of that story. So
wow.
My life changed in material ways immediately. And I had written that story in about 2 hours, and I got enough money to pay for half the car at least. And I thought, wow, I'm going to write a story a week or a story a month. And you know, I saw myself with a fleet of Ramblers, but it didn't work out that way. I didn't sell another story for 3 years, and then it was to a small, prestigious literary magazine called New American Review, and I got $125 for it, and I was just as thrilled. So I knew I wasn't just in it for the money.
Were you worried when you started writing that you wouldn't have great themes because you had spent your adult life living in the suburbs?
Well, I've had to overcome that. I still worry about that, but I still claim that everything that happens in the bedroom and the kitchen matters more than what happens in the boardroom and the White House.
Did the women's movement give you courage to make that change?
Without any question. The feminine mystique was a very strong influence in my life. It gave me permission, not just courage. It really gave me permission to think of myself as a writer rather than as just a housewife.
Was there any resistance from your husband?
Some, definitely. I think he'd admit that. And gradually that went away, too. Mm-hmm. In fact, he has become the chief cook and bottle washer.
It is interesting to me, though, that you were able to basically start a new life while keeping the life that you had. A lot of people, when they make a really big change in their life, like becoming a writer, aren't able to contain that change within their current life, and they end up with some kind of divorce or a big move, something like that.
Well, it was really hard. It was a lot of work. It was a balancing act, really. I was given a Guggenheim fellowship in 1976 when I was writing In the Flesh, and one of the things I did with the money was hire a housekeeper part-time who took some of those duties away. And it was hard to relinquish them. When you do something all the time, like cooking and cleaning, you're proud of it. It's your job, and you want to do it well. I no longer want to do that part of the job. I just prefer writing.
Now, your daughter Meg started publishing when she was 22, I think, her first novel.
Well, she published a short story when she was 11.
Oh gosh, did you react to that with both pride and a little bit of jealousy because she started so young?
You can't be jealous of your children. You just can't be. It was sheer pride. I think I wish I too could have had an early start so that I could, you know, make lots of mistakes and look forward to a long future of writing. But these things happen when they happen.
Do you and your daughter talk much about writing, or do you read each other's manuscripts?
We do all that, and we gossip a great deal, and it's fun. It's really nice.
The opening inscription for your new novel, Silver, is a quote from jazz singer Helen Humes, who sang with the Count Basie Band for a while. I think that's probably what she's most famous for.
It's a great quote, isn't it?
Yeah, why don't you read it and tell us where she said it and why you used it?
Trying to remember where I saw it. It was in a book about jazz by Whitney Balliot. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the name of the book, and this is a Helen Humes quote. "I've had a very happy life, and I wouldn't do it otherwise. I even got married once and survived."
What appealed to you about that?
Oh, the irony of it, the wit, and the courage of it.
Okay. Hilma Wolitzer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Hilma Wolitzer's new novel, Silver, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
How are you responding to Michael Dukakis' surprise choice of Lloyd Benson as his running mate?
Feverishly. We'll have a report from Linda Wertheimer about the announcement, about who Lloyd Benson is, what his political background is, and what the logic of his nomination is to Governor Dukakis. Also, a reaction from the NAACP meeting here in Washington, D.C. today, where George Bush spoke. Also, we hope to have reaction from Reverend Jesse Jackson, who was said to be very angry about it. That and also a reporter's notebook from Nepal, a special piece by producer Scott Carrier.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The English writer Muriel Spark is probably best known for her novel The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. The central character in Spark's new novel, A Far Cry from Kensington, is a 29-year-old woman living and working in post-war London. Book critic John Leonard says Spark has created a smart, witty heroine.
Meet Mrs. Hawkins, war widow, book editor, advice giver, earth mother, moralist. For most of Muriel Spark's quite wonderful short novel, Mrs. Hawkins is overweight. Later on, she will be beautiful. Always, consulting herself like a compass, she finds inside our mess of memory and desire a moral pole towards which her knowing needle points, true north. To a famous novelist with a difficult sex life, this Mrs. Hawkins says, "But you know very well, Miss Loy, that here in England, love and hate are two entirely different things. They are not even opposites. According to my outlook, love comes in the first place from the heart, and hate arises basically from principle." Just think about that. Hate arises basically from principle. On principle, Mrs. Hawkins hates Hector Bartlett, would-be big-time author. This hatred, which begins on aesthetic grounds and eventually arrives at a higher plateau of good and evil, costs her several jobs in the small world of British publishing in the dreary 1950s. Although Hector is unpublishable, he is well-connected and malevolent. But it's as if, for Mrs. Hawkins, not hating Hector would compromise her self-respect. He is, after all, a toad. I quote, "He vomits literary matter. He urinates and sweats. He excretes it." I've no doubt that A Far Cry from Kensington has caused wincing and flinches in England. Spark's portrait of these many writers and editors is so matter-of-factly savage. But the book is more than just a literary send-up, with so much plot and so few pages that it ought to seem cluttered. There are, for instance, a number of vivid eccentrics to contemplate in the Kensington boarding house that is a sort of mirror image of the world of publishing. Wanda, the Polish refugee dressmaker, for instance, and Mabel, the airhead who is always on the telephone, expecting everyone else in the world to indulge her as much as her father did, and William, who loves Mrs. Hawkins as much as I do, and for whom we feel sorry, because he knows Dostoevsky, but not Miss Muffet, Schopenhauer, but not Humpty Dumpty. And there's the silly magazine run by left-wing homosexual American expatriates hiding out from Joe McCarthy. Not to mention radionics, a black box business that leads to blackmail, witchcraft, and a kind of murder by remote control. And all the while, we're listening to an endless amount of odd but sound advice from Mrs. Hawkins on everything from diet to marriage to rheumatism to cats to when one should and shouldn't go to Paris. Instead of clutter, this is richness, a kind of Russian matryoshka doll where everything fits inside everything else. Witty and wicked as it is, however, A Far Cry from Kensington triumphs on the one hand as a character study every bit as brilliant as Sparks' The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, and on the other hand as an account of evil in the humdrum, career-minded world. Evil next door and banal. Evil that begins in bad writing and ends in life itself, made ugly and brutal and foreclosed. Imagine, if you can, Doris Lessing with a sense of humor.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Muriel Spark's new novel, A Far Cry from Kensington. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the new album from cellist Yo-Yo Ma, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will take on that American institution, the Spelling Bee. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Orjiva Blaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.